We are here today because the court below dismissed the complaint at issue in this appeal, despite well-pled allegations of entrenchment. In particular, the complaint alleges in great detail that the defendants, who were the directors and officers of First Niles, breached their fiduciary duties when, acting for reasons unrelated to their good faith informed business judgment, but instead motivated by a desire to entrench themselves, acted to 1) reject a value-maximizing bid, and 2) instead adopt a share reclassification or so-called going dark transaction whereby the shares were delisted from NASDAQ. As a result,
could you put the microphone slightly closer?
Is that better?
Yeah.
Thanks. As a result of these transactions and this conduct, plaintiffs were denied a substantial premium for their shares. The public market was eliminated, while at the same time the defendants ensured that their jobs would be maintained and secure and that they would not face the same liquidity crisis that plaintiffs face. The complaint's allegations of disloyal and self-serving conduct are based on firsthand observations of plaintiff Lenneth Gantler, who during many of the relevant time periods was a member of the board of directors of the defendant First Niles. The complaint's conclusions of wrongdoing are based on Mr. Gantler's impressions of events that he observed. And while one could reach a different impression on the same observed facts, perhaps when they are fully developed, that's not what's at issue here today. Today we were here on a motion to dismiss, and the relevant standard dictates that the factual permutations reasonably possible within the framework of plaintiff's allegations must be considered, and whether relief would be considered under any of those factual permutations is the relevant standard. Plaintiffs submit that they have met this standard. I know that the court has read the brief, so I won't go into all the factual detail. However, I would like to highlight some of the facts that the court below either ignored or didn't give proper consideration to, and I will do that within the framework of the context of the claims discussed. First, I'm going to discuss the legal and factual framework for the claims against the director defendants for entrenchment. Then I will turn to the claims against the officer defendants, Stevens and Safrick. And finally, if there's time, I'll turn to the defendants' ratification defense. First, the entrenchment claims. Doesn't matter whether this court views these claims under the rubric of UNICAL or business judgment, because the directors are liable for breach of fiduciary duty. They rejected the first place bid and instead pursued the reclassification for reasons unrelated to their good faith informed business judgment and for the purpose of entrenchment. With respect to the entrenchment allegations, the court below found these unexceptional. I submit that that is wrong, Your Honor. First, the complaint pleads both a motive to entrench and substantial actions consistent with this entrenchment motive. With respect to the motive, it cannot be denied that the defendants knew that if the sale were to go through, they would be removed from office. For example, the complaint at paragraphs 22 and 33 states that bid letters received said they would be removed. Moreover,
Ms. Sheldon, sure. Just to make sure I grasp your point, your claim is that the breach of fiduciary duty took place at the time that the bid was rejected?
Yes, although the subsequent action of instead, well, there's two claims, Your Honor. One relates to the reclassification, one relates to the sale. The reclassification claim also informs the sale because the subsequent actions show action consistent with entrenchment.
But that's evidentiary, isn't it?
Yes, but it is pled, and what we are here on a motion to dismiss, so all of those facts can be considered in.
I understand that. Your primary argument is that the breach of fiduciary duty took place the moment the board voted to reject the premium bid. Is that
yes,
right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And, you know, the events that took place a year or so later, only served to confirm the improper motive that the board had for doing that.
Yes, that's true, but the board knew at the time. The fact pattern is that the board authorized the company be sold. At the next board meeting thereafter, the officers presented a proposal which would maintain their positions. So the board then knew as of that time that there was an alternative whereby they could keep their positions.
Okay. Is there any other transaction that's independent of this transaction the subject of a claim for breach of fiduciary duty?
Well, there are two claims, Your Honor, but with respect to the first claim of the sale, there is no other independent transaction. However, there are facts alleged.
Well, let me make sure I understand the facts that the rejection of the sale. As I understand the briefs and your complaint, the board basically voted to reject the sale, according to you, without any discussion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the vote was 4-1.
That's right.
And then immediately after they rejected the sale without discussion or analysis, according to your complaint, the next agenda item was the reclassification.
That's correct.
And your argument is that your complaint supports the proposition that the sequence of events demonstrates that even though this board authorized the sale, once they found out there was an alternative to the sale that might perpetuate them in office, they rejected the sale out of hand without any discussion and moved on to the transaction that would keep them in power.
Well said, much better than I could, Your Honor. I want to add one additional point to that, and it's not just, and these are two points that the court below didn't really consider. One is that the rejection was done without any deliberation. The other was done that it was done against the advice of its financial advisor. Therefore, to the extent that one would like to argue and believe that this is done in good faith, no such inference can be based on these facts.
Well, isn't consideration of the advice or even knowledge of the advice a form of deliberation?
No, Your Honor. I would say that knowledge of the advice may be a consideration, but it's not a deliberation. And here where you have defendant directors acting against the advice of the financial advisor, they cannot claim any other economic rationality for their decision. And that's especially true given that they lack deliberation. If you don't get together in a room and say, hey, we got this advice, do you think it's good? And you don't come to a you don't talk about it, there's no way that you can come to a conclusion that it isn't good. You can't say, oh, well, they used the wrong multiples, they did this wrong, they did that wrong. If you have no deliberations whatsoever, the only conclusion that one can reach is that you acted for reasons other than economic rationality.
I understand what your argument in your briefs, it is that the directors may have an explanation, but at least based on the allegations in your complaint, it should withstand the motion to dismiss.
That's exactly true, Your Honor, because the allegations show that there was a value-maximizing bid that was rejected against the advice of the financial advisors with no deliberation, and those fact patterns, I submit, suggest an entrenchment motive, that these officers could not have been acting for, and directors could not have been acting for any other reason but their self-interest. And in fact,
is that the case any time there's the rejection of a bid?
No, because this bid was rejected without deliberation and against the advice of the financial advisors, and those facts set this case apart from most of the mere rejection cases that the court has determined or decided in the past, such as Pogus.
Let me clear up some confusion. I thought that in response to Justice Holland's question, you stated that the next agenda item, once the board voted down the sale, was the reclassification. Was it the privatization? Reclassification didn't come up until almost a year later.
At that point, it was an officer proposal, which was a precursor to the reclassification.
Privatization, right?
Yeah, I mean, it suggested various different courses of action which were similar to the reclassification. I want to make one point. I noted earlier that because the directors cannot claim any economic rationality for their decision since they went against the advice of their financial advisor, the only conclusion that the court can reach is that this was based on self-interest on these particular facts pled. That conclusion is consistent with Defendant Stevens' comments at the March 9th board meeting, which are alleged in the complaint, that the First Nile stock price was not his concern. Rather, he was concerned with maintaining his position and the positions for his colleagues.
Okay, so if this storyline ended at the conclusion of the meeting at which the sale was rejected. In your view, the complaint would state a claim sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss, that the refusal, that the turndown of the sale was a breach of fiduciary duty. Do I have that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
Now, do I also have it right that independent and apart from that, the reclassification, which ultimately was effectuated, I gather, a year later, is an independent basis for an independent claim or a second claim?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, can you sketch the argument there?
Sure, Your Honor. The reclassification claim is a claim which is to be decided under the rubric of business judgment. And there, Your Honor, we believe that we've adequately alleged that each of the directors is interested.
Now, at that time, Mr. Gantler was no longer on the board.
That's correct. That each of the defendants is interested and that the transaction caused harm in that it eliminated the market for first place or for First Nile stock, but the defendants were not equally affected. And in particular, the officer defendants, who include Stevens and Costanzas, had.
Am I right that on this second board action, the vice chancellor concluded three out of the five had a conflict?
That's correct.
This is almost like a reverse stock split.
Yes.
Maybe it was. And that's a device that has been used, you know, in public companies that want to deregister under the 1934 Act. How is this, in isolation, putting aside what happened the year before, how is this transaction any different?
Well, and it's different in its structure in that there is no actual reverse split. The shares are reclassified. It's very similar to a case that Your Honor decided, Hamilton versus Nosco, in which you get below
about 100 years ago.
you get below the 300 share limit for.
It was an exchange offer instead of a reverse stock split.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Okay, so it only affected those minority shareholders who were exchanging, correct? Public shareholders who chose to exchange.
Well, no, Your Honor, because we allege that it affected everyone who, even if your shares were not reclassified, your market was eliminated. And by the way, the plaintiffs, none of their shares were reclassified. They had more shares than necessary for reclassification, so none of their shares were reclassified.
I'm sorry, was this transaction a compulsory transaction, or was there a...
No, it was voluntary.
What's that?
What, do you mean compulsory by the...
I mean, in order to get to the point where, the number of shareholders sufficient to deregister was reached, did that require any voluntary activity on the part of the shareholders?
Yes, they had to vote in favor of it because the certificate of incorporation was changed.
And there's no allegation of coercion?
No allegation of coercion, but there are allegations of wrongful disclosure.
Yeah. That's your middle argument, so to speak, that to the extent your opponents are arguing or relying on ratification by virtue of the shareholder vote, that you can't do that because the disclosures were inadequate.
That's correct. And there is also a second argument with respect to ratification and defendants' affirmative defense there, and that is that even if there was full information regarding the ratification, the defendants have not proved their burden of showing ratification because such affirmative defense will only operate if a majority of the outstanding disinterested shares voted in favor of the reclassification after full and complete disclosure.
And that relates to the part of the briefs on the mathematical computation and whether or not the vice chancellor could take judicial notice of those things he took into consideration to come down to the conclusion that it was, 50.8% or 2%, something like that.
That's correct. But the real issue is whether or not the shares affiliated with defendants meet the interested standard of ratification. And plaintiffs submit that you cannot get to which shares are interested without going outside the record and making a factual determination with respect to interest. And in particular,
was that argument raised below?
It was, Your Honor. We argued that you could not make this determination without going outside the record. We did not say the specific facts that we would rely on outside the record.
And so by analogy, it would be like our prior cases that say you can't look at an indemnification or exculpation clause in a certificate of incorporation on a motion to dismiss, because once you go outside the record, you have to develop it fully. You might do it on summary judgment, but not on a motion to dismiss. So to the extent we look at the allegations in your complaint and they come back and say, well, ratification solves all the problems, your argument is we can't address ratification based on the allegations in your complaint.
That's correct, because you cannot make a determination of the number of interested shares. I see that I'm well into my rebuttal time, so with your indulgence, I'll sit down and let my opponent make their presentation.
Thank you. Good morning again.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, a phrase that the Chancery Court used to describe some of plaintiff's allegations in this case really can be used to sum up their entire case, and that is routine and unexceptional. This is a very routine and common case of a former director who disagrees with the direction that the other directors have taken here, and instead of merely accepting that as a difference in business judgment when reasonable minds can differ on the direction a company should go, they've chosen to bring this lawsuit. And in connection with that, the plaintiffs argue that the directors and officers breached their fiduciary duties when they decided not to sell the company, which of course is something they had every right to do and something that companies do every day. There's no special allegations that make this case anything other than routine and unexceptional, because there's no allegation that as a product of this decision not to sell, these directors and members of management gained anything whatsoever that they didn't have before, either something that was a personal benefit to them or anything that allowed them to have a greater control over the company, increased voting power, or anything like that.
But they continued in office, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They did continue in office, but nothing about the decision not to sell, and then later the reclassification, which we talked about here, provided them any more job security than they had before either of those decisions.
Why did they decide not to sell?
I don't know. I don't know why they decided not to sell. They thought it was in the best, I mean, I don't know, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know specifically why they decided not to sell. They decided that it was not in the best interest of the company at that time to accept the deal that was before them. And after that, a year and a half later, they came to the conclusion that the best thing to do for the company was to reclassify, which is something, again, that's very routine and unexceptional for small banks like First Niles. This is a single branch bank in a small town called Niles, Ohio. They have a very local shareholder base. They don't enjoy a high trading volume. Being a public company was very expensive for them, and they simply weren't getting the benefit of all that time, money, and effort they were putting into filing SEC filings and preparing for Sarbanes-Oxley compliance.
Well, this wasn't just a routine deregistration transaction, was it? I mean, it passed by just a wisp above a quarter of a percent of the voting. The shares entitled to vote. At least that's the case if we credit the vice chancellor's opinion. And it also involved not only eliminating the public market for the shares, but also the power of the shareholders who took the preferred stock to vote. Wouldn't that have the effect of insulating the directors?
No, Your Honor.
From any shareholder scrutiny, that is, from any removal?
No, Your Honor, and I think there may be a misunderstanding. There's no allegation in the complaint, and in fact, the complaint acknowledges that as a result of the reclassification, none of the shareholders, whether they were reclassified or not, lose their ability to vote on any change of control transaction.
Change of control, yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
How about a routine election of directors?
You're right, Your Honor. They do not maintain the ability to vote on directors.
They couldn't mount a contest to replace the board after this transaction.
No, Your Honor, I believe that's correct.
Well, so. And doesn't a lot of your success for your clients depend on the ratification? And once the vice chancellor concludes a majority of the board was conflicted, in order to uphold this transaction, we really need to look at the ratification, don't we?
Well, Your Honor, I believe there are still two. You're right. If we keep the Chancery's court opinion as it is, then ratification is our way to business judgment. But we submit, and I would like to argue here today, that the Chancery Court's decision that Mr. Kramer lacked independence.
All right. Well, we're going to give you plenty of time to talk about that. But let's just focus on the implications. And if we assume the Court of Chancery was correct, that three of the five were conflicted, and then your success depends on ratification, tell us why it was proper for the court to take judicial notice of everything it had to do to engage in the computation that concluded this had been ratified.
Yes, Your Honor. The Chancery Court took judicial notice of two pieces of information. One, share totals contained in the proxy, the numbers in the proxy, which the plaintiff never challenged below and, in fact, had cited to those numbers herself. And the numbers of shares attributed to each director and officer that are alleged in the complaint match those in the proxy. The second piece of information that the Chancery Court took judicial notice of was the vote certification, and the plaintiffs have never alleged that there was any wrongdoing or any challenge to that vote certificate at all. And it's certainly something that's not subject to reasonable dispute and was proper for the Chancery Court to take judicial notice of. So we submit that there was nothing improper about taking judicial notice of either piece of information, and so the ratification defense should stand.
The other aspect of the ratification depends on the accuracy of the disclosures. And your opponent argues, relying on Arnold versus Bancorp, that this was a situation where the disclosures gave part of the story but not all of the story, and therefore, consistent with our holding in Arnold, we should conclude these disclosures were inadequate.
Your Honor, the Chancery Court correctly held that we did disclose the full story in the proxy, and specifically, I think the two allegations from the plaintiff that go to sort of completing the story are with regard to the sales transaction. And remember, this proxy was for approval of the reclassification, not for approval of the board's decision not to sell. But in any event, even going beyond, the court found that the allegations or that the disclosures were appropriate with regard to plaintiff's first claim, which is that the officers and directors didn't put enough information in the proxy statement about the fact that that management, in their opinion, had sabotaged due diligence. The Chancery Court found that there was no specific facts or arguments that the plaintiffs had made that would show that anything the management did could be seen as a sabotage. So there was nothing additionally that should have been included in the proxy statement. The plaintiffs also argue that the proxies were inadequate because they should have talked about the lack of deliberation in connection with the sale decision. But again, the Chancery Court found that there weren't any allegations to lead him to believe that there was a lack of deliberation, and so certainly no reason for the first Niles to include that information in the proxy statement. And they also said that it wouldn't have been material in any event. The sentence that's challenged is that after, and this is from the proxy at page 14, that after careful deliberations, the board rejected the first place offer. And the court said below it wouldn't have made a difference if they had taken out the word careful or if they had taken out that introductory phrase whatsoever. It wouldn't have made a material difference to the shareholders who were voting. And again, especially in light of the fact that the purpose of the proxy was for the shareholders to have information about the reclassification and decide if they wanted to adopt a reclassification. One more point on the reclassification decision, and the reason the business judgment rule applies is because it was approved by a board made up of a majority of disinterested and independent directors. The Chancery Court properly held that Mr. Eady and Mr. Shaker were disinterested and independent, but Mr. Kramer was also independent and disinterested. And the Chancery Court improperly found that he lacked independence from Stevens because at some point to someone, he mentioned that he might possibly someday want to work for the bank. There's no allegation in the amended complaint that this discussion happened with Mr. Stevens. It doesn't say who the discussion happened with, so there's no inference to be made that there was a quid pro quo in Mr. Kramer's vote for reclassification. All the cases cited by the plaintiff and all the cases relied on by the court in accepting plaintiff's argument all talk about current employment of a director for another interested director. There's never been a case where that I know of or that plaintiffs have cited where the court found a lack of independence based on the probable possibility or speculation that a director might later on in the future want to work for another director. And to do so would be to allow plaintiffs to avoid the business judgment rule simply by speculating that they might have at some point mentioned, man, I'd really like your job or I'd really like to work for your company.
But everything you're saying are normally things that are developed after the motion to dismiss is denied. And why are the allegations in this complaint inadequate? Why aren't they enough to withstand a motion to dismiss and have your client come forward with all of these great explanations?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that it doesn't require a great explanation. The only allegation challenging Mr. Kramer's independence and what the court found below was this possibility of future speculative employment. And the only allegation that supports that in the complaint is a sentence that says Mr. Kramer had discussed with someone that he might like to work for the bank after reclassification, and that's it. There's no inference to be made from that speculation that this was something he was seriously considered or was just something that he mentioned one day to somebody. And again, there's no allegation that he mentioned this or had a discussion with Stevens. There's no inference to be made that Mr. Stevens knew that Mr. Kramer would ever want to work for the bank. And if you look at the plaintiff's complaint, Mr. Kramer, the picture of him is painted as this, you know, blue-collar worker whose family owns a heating and air conditioning business. I don't even see that it would be reasonable to assume that he would ever be working in a bank if you accept plaintiff's allegations as true on those points.
Does the record disclose why the board decided to structure the reclassification in the way they did? That is, if the only purpose of this was simply to deregister the company under the 1934 Act, it could have been done or accomplished as a simple reverse stock split. But what they did here was to structure the transaction as an exchange offer that, apart from eliminating the public market for the company shares, would actually deprive the shareholders who received the voting power, I'm sorry, the preferred stock of voting power, with the exception of control transactions. What, if anything, does the record show was the reasoning behind that?
The record actually shows a good bit of information as to why they decided to go with reclassification. Of course, as Your Honor picked up on, the goal was to come out from under the burdens of being a public company and having all these reporting obligations.
I'm talking about why did they do it this way rather than in a way that would have preserved the voting power of the shareholders, at least those that held over 300 shares.
Why specifically they decided to do it in a way that the shareholders would retain the ability to vote on elections. Again, they retained voting rights in many respects. One thing that's incorporated in the complaint by reference is the privatization proposal from the management, and that lists specific reasons for why reclassification was preferred over other methods. The first of those reasons is likelihood of success. They thought these shareholders would prefer to be able to keep their stock and not be forced to not be part of the company anymore. Again, this is a small town bank, and you've got a lot of community around this bank. Secondly, was because to reclassify wouldn't require the company to put out any money to purchase back any shares. So it left a lot, the maximum amount of money for the management to pursue other opportunities.
Well, they could have issued a voting preferred.
I'm sure there are lots of different, I'm afraid I'm not familiar with all the different ways that this might have been able to happen. But the company, you know, as set forth in the fact that this proposal sort of started out looking at different ways they could do privatization, reclassification being only one of those, and they ultimately decided in their business judgment that it was the best thing for this company at the time to do it the way they did it. Of course, there were other ways that they could have, but with the privatization proposal and even plaintiffs' own allegations show that they had, there's plenty of information to find that they made this decision ultimately to go with reclassification in good faith. Again, for the reasons that it was also the cheapest to implement, which was a big part of it. The company didn't want to have to outlay a lot of money to make this happen, and reclassification allowed them a way to do that, as set forth in the privatization proposal.
Cheaper to issue a non-voting preferred than a voting preferred?
I'm afraid I don't know, Your Honor, but I do know that cost was a reason set forth for why they decided to go with the reclassification decision. The sale, there are two decisions that the plaintiffs are challenging here, the reclassification decision, of course, which we've been discussing, but also the decision not to sell. And this decision was protected by the business judgment rule, too. Plaintiffs claim that UNICAL should apply to that decision, but UNICAL cannot apply because the two things that are needed for UNICAL to apply are not present here, one being a threat and two being defensive actions taken in response to that threat. Plaintiffs argue that they don't have to show that there was a threat, but without a threat, it would be impossible to apply the UNICAL question of whether the defensive measure adopted was reasonable in relation to the threat posed. And there simply was no threat here. Plaintiffs acknowledge in their complaint that the first place bid, the bid that was rejected, made no mention of whether the current board or management would be retained. At the very least, though, what the parties agree on for UNICAL to apply is that there must be defensive actions taken. And here there were none. Plaintiffs argue that rejection of the sale itself was the defensive action, but it has no characteristics of a defensive action. As I mentioned before, nothing about rejecting the offer provided these directors and officers any increased power or ability to defend against other offers than they had before that. Plaintiffs also argue that the reclassification decision made over a year later was the defensive measure adopted. But again, that decision wasn't contemporaneous. It was over a year later. And secondly, it itself does not have any characteristics of a defensive measure.
What exactly was discussed after they decided to reject the sale, you know, at the first board action? They moved on and they said, all right, we're rejecting this bid for no reason that we can see in the record. They've apparently decided we're not going to sell the company, although it's hard to find that in the record. But then they say, let's discuss what else we can do. How would you characterize the next agenda item on that first board meeting? What else were they discussing?
The record shows that what occurred was they decided not to sell, and then at that point, this was still a company that was faced with the burdens of Sarbanes-Oxley and SEC reporting, and as prudent management and directors, they needed to deal with that problem, which was definitely staring them down in the face. And so they moved on to discuss how are we going to cease being a public company and come out from under these burdens. And then they moved on and discussed different ways to do that, reclassification being one of those.
Well, in an expanded record, wouldn't we expect to find facts to this effect? We've decided to sell the company. Now we have a bid. We're rejecting that bid, either because it's inadequate or we've changed our mind. We're no longer going to sell the company. And in your scenario, they've concluded they're no longer going to sell the company. And then the facts as they develop would say, now that we've decided to stay independent, we still don't like the cost of Sarbanes-Oxley. What are our options? And the argument from your opponent is that all of the facts in what I've just related to you is what should be developed through discovery, but that what they've alleged, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, is a decision to sell the company, a board that has second thoughts because they don't want to lose their current positions. They're interested in entrenchment, which UNICAL refers to as the omnipresent specter that you might want to stay entrenched. And then they pursued alternatives that would allow them to stay in office. And based on those allegations, the motion to dismiss should have been denied, an answer to the complaint should have been filed, and discovery should have been taken.
But there's nothing in the amended complaint, first of all, to support. There must be some allegations that we can work with from the plaintiff's complaint to show that there was bad faith taken here in the decision not to sell. That's not there. With regard to reclassification, this wasn't something that cut off the ability to sell. And really, there is no allegation in the complaint that the sales process really ended. They had this bid before them. They rejected it. They didn't say we're never going to consider an offer to sell again. And nothing about reclassification precluded that from happening.
Well, where do we see all this? A moment ago, you told me they decided the company was no longer for sale. Now, admittedly, they could change their mind. But where do we see in the record a decision to sell the company, then a short time later, a decision that the company was no longer for sale without any explanation? Where's that in the record?
I don't think it is in the record, and I think that's exactly defendant's point, is they were looking at strategic opportunities, and included in that might have been potential business combinations or a sale. They had a couple of bids, then they ended up with an offer. They decided this is not the right offer for us at this time. For whatever reason, there's no allegation that they decided that in bad faith. They simply rejected it in the normal course. And then, you know, a year and a half later or so, they decided to reclassify, which never precluded them from, again, from selling. They could have sold all along. They could have sold. They could sell today. Another point to make, however, is that plaintiff's complaint sets forth that the reason these directors started along the path of looking for a sales process in the first place was because they were worried about management succession. So to say that they decided not to sell because they suddenly realized that that might leave them without jobs is not a reasonable inference, because they knew that all along, according to plaintiffs, and their reasoning for going into the sale process in the first place.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see I have about 14 seconds, so if there are no questions, I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to begin with the last point made with respect to the management succession. That had no effect on the board members maintaining their jobs. As so long as they could find someone else to manage this company, the company would continue. I'd also like to turn to the question that one of Your Honors posed with respect to what was on the table at the time, the complaint at paragraph 55, which is incidentally informed by the other proposals that had been made, said that at that point the investigation considered a change in the domicile of the company, reincorporation outside of Delaware, and a transfer to a federally funded or state-chartered bank, as well as the other aspects of the privatization proposal that were there before. And those items were all items that would have been expensive because there would have been dissenter rights.
Do we know what the privatization proposal consisted of, as distinguished from the ultimate reclassification transaction that was adopted?
Well, the complaint, Your Honor, talks about three different proposals. The first is made at the first board meeting after the sale is authorized, and that was made by Defendant Safarik. And at that time, he made a proposal urging that the board abandon the sale process and as alleged in the complaint, embrace a proposal similar to the now advanced reclassification, which includes plans to delist from the NASDAQ, switch to a federally chartered savings bank, and reincorporate in Maryland. So that was the first proposal. And then thereafter, there's the December 10th, they get the bids. And at the next meeting, Safarik again makes a proposal to the board. And in that proposal, that's the meeting of December 10 proposal. That's in paragraph 36 of the complaint. It includes recommendations similar to the officer-sponsored proposal from September 7th, company-sponsored share buyback program to allow for delisting, as well as other detailed cost savings, a majority of which would be obtained by a state bank charter, eliminating the OTC regulatory requirements and converting from a Delaware to Maryland company. And with respect to the privatization proposal, the cost savings, again, I think they were concerned about dissenters' rights because a reincorporation or something like that would give rise to those rights, and they were afraid that shareholders would exercise those rights, or they were going to do perhaps a management company-sponsored stock buyback, and that would have been expensive as well. I want to turn to the disclosure claims briefly. I have 1 minute left. My opponent argues that the disclosures with respect to the sale process were not material, but I submit that that is an error. Here, the proxy statement specifically claims that the sale process was rejected because a sale would be narrower, not as narrow in scope as a reclassification. And to the extent that the board suggested that sale was an alternative, they had an obligation to disclose material facts with respect to that sale. And one of those material facts includes the reasons why no definitive bid was submitted by Cortland, and in particular, management's lack of cooperation with due diligence. And there is a partial disclosure problem. In particular, the complaint or the proxy misleadingly says at page 41, incidentally, of the appendix, that as a result of further negotiations in March 2005, one of the bidders presented a definitive merger proposal to the board. It does not say that the other bidder did not present a proposal because they could not engage in due diligence because management refused to provide them with the requested information. And that fact pattern, Your Honor, I think is further supportive of plaintiffs' entrenchment claims.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.